Hello and welcome to this week's Oxcast Extra. I'm here with Dr. Caroline Larrington and she's going to talk about her latest book, Winter is Coming. Hiya.
Hello.
So your latest book, Winter is Coming, explores the legends found in the hugely popular Game of Thrones. Are you a big fan of Game of Thrones?
I'm a massive fan of Game of Thrones, yes. I cottoned on to it a bit late. I only started watching it on the plane going to America in 2012. And I became interested in it because I'd already heard the second series was going to be filmed partly in Iceland, and I'm really interested in Iceland and Icelandic literature. And so I watched three episodes on the trot on the plane, and by the time I got off, I was completely hooked.
Have you now read the books as well?
Yeah, that's what I think of as the lost summer of 2012. So as soon as I finished watching episode one, and then I couldn't watch series two because it was halfway through by the time I'd caught up with series one, I just read the books for the whole summer of the Olympics. And then at the end, I kind of went, oh, right, roll on season three.
After reading the series, what made you decide to then write your own book, exploring the legends?
Well, I'm a medievalist by profession. I teach medieval literature. And one of the things that I really like both about the books and about the show is how well George Martin and the showrunners too, Benioff and Weiss, understand the medieval world. And it's clear that although the research doesn't show, that Martin has done a massive amount of reading and he really does get things right. He really understands the dynamics of medieval society.
What was your process in writing the book?
Well, I was having lunch with my editor at IB Tauris, who've published the book. We were both talking about the show and what great fans we were. And he said, would you like to write a book about it? And I thought, well, yeah, maybe I could. And I was trying to find a way of writing about book and show together that wouldn't be just the kind of fangirl discussion of who was going to end up on the Iron Throne, though, you know, clearly that's something that's very interesting, or rehearsing my favourite bits of the plot. But what I wanted to do and what I decided to do was to imitate work which is very popular in the medieval period, and that was a journey from England to Jerusalem and then from Jerusalem out into the east, undertaken or supposedly undertaken by somebody called Sir John Mandeville, who was a knight who came from St Albans. And it's fairly clear that in fact this person never existed and he never went anywhere, but he just sat somewhere and made things up. And he drew upon quite a lot of contemporary travel literature, but he didn't go anywhere himself. So the idea behind the book is that we're going to go on a journey through Westeros, first of all, starting at the Wall and then going down the King's Road to King's Landing, and then further into other seven kingdoms. Then we go across the Narrow Sea to the Free Cities, and then rather dangerously, well, we don't go too close to Valyria. I mean, clearly that would be a very bad idea. So we gallop across the Dothraki Sea and find out about the Dothraki. And then we go to the cities of Slaver's Bay. And finally, when you start getting to those very sketchy areas like Aes Hai, it's time to turn around and come home again. So it's a journey through Westeros and Essos. And the first chapter explains some things about medieval society, which are general to Westeros, not so much to Essos.
Where's your favourite part of the journey?
That's a good question. Actually, I really like the Wall and the area just to the north of the Wall. Even though it raises some questions for me, like, you know, how do they manage to have so many trees north of the Wall? And what's Craster's pigs? What are they living off? And kind of quite solid economic questions like that. But I really find the various clans who live north of the Wall very interesting. And the whole concept of both whites and the White Walkers, or the others as they're known in the book, is, I think, really fascinating. They're very hard to account for, in the sense, the White Walkers. What kinds of creatures are they? What can work against them? Can they be kept from overrunning Westeros?
Who knows?
No, I'm not at all sure, I have to say.
What's your favourite legend or fact used by George R.R. Martin?
Again, it's a kind of northern thing, I think. I like the idea of the whites as the undead. And you find creatures like this in Icelandic literature, in sagas, quite a lot. If you're not very careful with dead people, particularly if they're outsiders and kind of antisocial and unpleasant in life, they can turn antisocial and unpleasant in death, and they come out of their burial mounds and they walk around the farm, they destroy the livestock, sometimes they ride on the farmhouse roof, and they're really difficult to deal with. It takes a real hero to kind of wrestle them back into being properly dead. And then you have to cut their heads off and put their heads where they can't find them and put them back on again. So sometimes this means what can be very effective is sticking the nose into the buttocks, because that really confuses the white. No, he can't find his way home again after that. But burning them is really effective too. And in one Icelandic story, the ashes are then sealed in a lead casket and dropped into a boiling hot spring. So after that, you're fairly sure that the guy's not going to come back again. That's, I think, one of the things I find most interesting, the rules around how the whites can behave.
That's fascinating. I guess it feeds quite a lot into maybe our modern day ideas around zombies and the undead, in a sense.
Yeah, because the whites don't seem to speak any more than the zombies do, whereas the Icelandic undead don't tend to talk a lot, but they can talk if they want to. Well, the most famous one has quite a long speech in which he threatens the hero. But yes, it has got quite a lot to do with the zombies. And I think the more you see mass whites, as we saw at the Battle of Hardhome, just everybody who dies gets up and starts walking again, the more terrifying it is and the more like a zombie army it is. It really gives you a sense that they're unstoppable and the dead are going to overwhelm the living. And there's not much you can do about it unless you've got the really massive supply of dragon glass somewhere.
Well, let's hope so.
Well, you can mine it on Dragonstone, apparently, Stannis says. So there's some hope.
But yes. Let's go somewhere a bit warmer now. Where does the idea of the Dothraki people come from?
Martin himself says that the Dothraki are kind of crossed between the Mongols and certain Native American tribes. And I think the whole business of not cutting your braid unless you're defeated, in which case you can, you know, chop it off and throw it in front of the people who've defeated you, as the Dothraki did with the Unsullied. That, I think, is Native American. But most of the rest of the Dothraki society seems to be organised very much along the lines of Mongol society. Mm. And we know quite a lot about this because various kind of unfortunate priests and friars were sent by the Pope or by various European kings to the court of Genghis Khan in the 13th century. And there's some very sad accounts of them. They usually write their own stories after they've been there and got back successfully, about, in one case, what a terrible idea it was to leave Constantinople just wearing sandals once you get up into the high mountains, and how horrible fermented mare's milk is as a drink, and how strange Mongol society is in terms of always being on the move, having these yurts or yers as they call them, and going from place to place all the time. And there's some interesting evidence that the idea of the Dosh Kalin, the widows who all live at the capital of Dothraki society, women in Mongol society, widows also had a lot of power and they kept their husband's possessions. The widow of, I think it was not Genghis Khan, but his son Munkar Khan, I think, had 200 carts to carry her possessions around with.
Wow.
And she kept them after his death, so she just hung on to her authority. And I think Munkar also leaves his mother in charge of a couple of things when he's away somewhere else, travelling around the lands of the Mongols. And so there's quite a lot of very interesting material that I suppose Martin must have read that's gone into his formation of Dothraki society. And I even found, in fact, a kind of parallel to Daenerys eating the Thalian's heart to prophesy about her unborn child. It's not quite the same, but it's something a little bit like it. But to know about that, you'll have to buy the book.
This is so fascinating. So you've got an event on Thursday, the 3rd of December at Blackwell's Bookshop. What's happening?
Well, it all sounds really exciting. First of all, it's going to be a fancy dress event. And so I guess I get to pick who's got the best fancy dress costume. The fancy dress is optional. I'm not sure myself though I'm going to be walking through the streets of Oxford dressed as Daenerys in December weather. I'm going to have to think a bit harder about that. I may come as a direwolf. I think that may be a bit more comfortable. And we've also got a string duo, Daria Kulesh and her companion, are going to be playing the theme tune from the show. And in fact, some of the songs as well. So I'm planning to bring along some lyrics so that we can all sing along to The Reigns of Castamere and The Bear and the Maiden Fair. And there's going to be mead is included with the prize. I'm not sure how much mead they drink in King's Landing. I don't think Cersei necks all that much mead, but I think they do have it in the north. So I think that could be appropriate. And I'll be talking about some bits of the book and reading some bits out as well and inviting a discussion about some of the hot topics for season six.
Speaking of hot topics, I've got some questions for you. It's a bit of a quick fire round. Favourite house?
House Stark, they're the people for me. They look like losers at the moment, but I think they're going to pull through in the end.
A favourite character?
Favourite character. That's a bit trickier since so many people are dead, who I'm quite fond of. But I think probably it has to be Arya, even if I think she's lost her way a bit at the moment. I just admire the way she's stuck through everything that she believes in and the way that she's made it in that really difficult world by herself.
Least favourite character? That might be easier.
Least favourite character? That's a bit trickier as well. I would have said Daenerys' husband, not obviously Khal Drogo, who we all get to admire in the end, but the guy whose name has gone out of my head, of course, whom she marries, Khizr Lord Dark, something like that. Now, in the show, he gets killed in Dasnak's Pit, doesn't he? In the books, it looks as if he's in league with the bad guys in Meereen, the Sons of the Harpy, and we're not that sorry, I don't think, when he gets killed there. But I think he's kind of sneaky, and I think he probably is about my least favourite character so far.
Dragons or direwolves?
Oh, well, I'm a huge fan of dogs, so I really, really like the direwolves, I have to say. And I've always liked them, particularly in season one, where they were actually real puppy wolf-sized dogs. And now that they're fairly clearly wolves who are not in the same space as the actors. Yeah, I'm still pretty fond of the direwolves, but I've got quite a space in my heart for the dragons as well. We like dragons, like we medievalists. And I'm particularly impressed by the way that Daenerys' dragons can dive for fish without their fire going out. I think that's really impressive.
Yeah, hadn't even thought about that.
I certainly wonder when I saw them do it. So I guess they're not underwater for too long.
Yeah, interesting. Who would win in a fight, the Hound or the Mountain?
I think the Mountain probably would, you know, even though I got very fond of the Hound. And I was sorry. It's one of those moments where I wondered whether Arya wasn't just getting a bit too tough for this world when she left him. Of course, there are some fan theories that the Hound isn't dead and he might come back, but I kind of don't see it myself, not with the gangrene he seemed to be getting.
No, he really wasn't very well.
No.
And finally, who will win the Iron Throne?
Well, I don't want to utter any spoilers for people who haven't read the books, though I'm not convinced that the book's latest candidate is really going to pull through. And indeed, some people think that he's not even genuine. So I'm not going to mention him, though I do talk about him in the epilogue to the book, which is marked as containing serious spoilers. So don't read the epilogue if you don't want to know. I think I'm pretty inclined to the old Daenerys and Jon Snow are going to be reigning jointly on the Iron Throne. But there are still some other surprises, I think, up Martin's sleeve.
Definitely. Brilliant. Just finally, what do you think it is about Game of Thrones that makes it so popular?
I think it's the fact that the characters are not simple, any of them. I think if you compare it with Tolkien's world, for example, if you compare it with The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings, there you've got good guys and you've got bad guys. And you've got a couple of a bit conflicted guys. But basically, you know, orcs and goblins are bad and humans are good and elves are good, if a bit weird. And you know, hobbits are super good, even if they sometimes get tempted by the wrong. But everybody is much more complex in the world of Game of Thrones. And they have very strong political instincts as well, particularly in the world of King's Landing. I love to see the way that the small council and Varys and Littlefinger, who I almost nominated as my favourite character because he is so sneaky.
So sneaky.
But also so interesting, the idea that he's got this kind of hinterland where he loved Kat and he's got a weird thing for Sansa, which is a bit disturbing but interesting at the same time. Every time you think you really hate a character, which is why it's hard for me to decide who I dislike most, they do something which makes you think, oh, okay, you know, the Hound, he's not such a bad guy after all. I'm not terrifically sure I'm ever going to be saying that about the Mountain.
No, I have to say. I don't think so.
But we'll see.
Well, maybe.